few months ago, we were delighted on the Midweek Drive to actually meet someone I describe very much as a Renaissance woman. And lo and behold, we're actually in the same radio studio now to talk about, again, the value and importance of great holiday deals with, indeed, the people's champion, the all-time wonderful soul, who is Sarah Willingham. Sarah, how are you?
Wow, what an introduction, Alex. Thank you.
Always good to connect with you, and even better, actually, face-to-face.
It's lovely to meet you. Lovely to meet you.
So this extraordinary thing about travel and how actually, despite price comparison sites being out there and a whole range of things actually happening, we're still not getting the best deals in Britain.
Well, it's not so much that we're not getting the best deals in Britain. It's more about how do we get the best deals. And I think one of the things that have come out in this research is that most people, the majority of people, 76%, are going to a price comparison site thinking, this is where I'm going to get the cheapest price for my hotels. And actually, it's not the case. I don't know if you remember a year ago, we talked about Holiday Inn Express doing the lowest price promise. And this was basically saying, if you want to get the lowest price of booking a Holiday Inn Express, you have to go direct. Don't go through a price comparison site. Guaranteed. And actually, lots and lots of people did last year. And if, in fact, that had been across the whole InterContinental Hotel Group estate, that would have been a saving of £20 million to the consumer last year. Now, that's
significant.
That's significant, exactly. Really significant. So this year, hurrah, they have launched it across the estate. So it's, and what's been very interesting about the research that they've conducted off the back of this is it is showing that our behaviour, we are conditioned. You know, the massive market power that the online estate agents have and the online booking agents have, it's, we are conditioned to go to them, do our research, click, book, done, without going directly to the hotel.
It's become a phenomenon of the 21st century and, I suppose, the technological world we're living in. Is this almost a kind of hearkening back to days when actually that personal contact with hotels is actually important?
Oh, I hope so. I really hope so. Because part of the you know, it's such an interesting conversation because when you think about the online comparison sites, they of course the majority of people book through them, so they have enormous power and of course enormous importance. But what happens to the little man who's got his own or her own hotel, where they
the
are
independent, in
independent,
other words.
Where they've got they are now the power of those online. Online booking agencies means that actually the majority of their bookings are coming through those agencies.
Personally, Sarah, I blame the meerkats and the opera singers. You can only go so far with that, really.
You know,
please.
With those massive budgets, what can you do? And what I think is really interesting is research has shown that actually the size of the market hasn't expanded. So what's happened is people are still booking hotels, they're just booking them in a different way. So that is hurting the small businesses. So I love the fact that the large businesses are coming out now and saying, we guarantee if you come to us direct, you will get the lowest price by coming to us. And by doing that, they are forcing the way and they're going to help the smaller companies as well and the independents.
And how does this tech savviness, if you like, translate across the country? Because there are some very interesting regional differences in terms of where people come from. I'm always fascinated by the sort of data which has been drilled down into for this. You know, are there any parts of the country that actually do it particularly well in terms of saying, yes, we always go direct to the hotel?
Well, the Southwest actually have come out shining. They're nearly 20%, so 18% of people always go and book direct, which is actually very high if you consider, you know, that's one in five people will book direct. Wales and London, you know, are very low. And I think a lot of that is because, especially in London, there are so many apps that are available, for example, where it just makes it quick and easy, efficient. We're all super busy, crazy lives, click a button, done. And I think that stat is affected a lot by the convenience of so many of these booking apps that we're using.
And presumably, obviously, you have a wonderful family yourself, whether it's a family booking, whether it's a single travel, etc. These are savings that can be made right across the board, really, by taking that line, the advice, really, go directly to the hotel.
Oh, I mean, in a lot of instances, they are savings that will be made, not can be made. They're absolutely guaranteed. But one of the things that I always say is, even if a small independent hasn't stood up and said, I guarantee if you book directly with me, don't forget the amount of commission that is being paid to a booking online agency in order to get that hotel. You can't negotiate with a computer. But you can negotiate with a human being. And often there might be reward clubs, there might be some kind of relationship there, you might get Wi-Fi thrown in, free breakfast, upgrade. You know, have a conversation with a human being. Let's go back to our roots and remember that actually human beings are making these decisions. And that's how you will get the cheapest price this summer.
Inevitably, Sarah, we're going to be asked, where do we go to find more information? What would be the best website from your own perspective?
Well, from this, if you want to know more about this actual research, go to the Intercontinental Hotel Group website, the IHG website, and put in lowest price promise. Just Google it and loads more information will come up. I think there's been a lot of printed press on it as well over the last couple of days and today. So there'll be plenty of stuff around.
Well, normally when I'm up in the studio in Lincoln or indeed Teesside, I'll say, have you had a recent interesting telephone link? How are you returning, etc.? But from the point of view of it's been an absolute joy for myself. I know some of our midweek driveouts are very envious that I've been able to actually meet you in person, so it's been wonderful. Hopefully it's been a good interview for your own perspective.
Yes,
as well.
Thank you. And the mascot is here.
We do have Spike. We'll take a quick photograph, etc. On for the rest of the day.
Brilliant.
It's a glorious May morning, actually afternoon now, and it's another On Location audio report with Southside Broadcasting and Siren FM in association with Farmer Nord. And I normally say we find ourselves, well, actually, we don't have any midweek driveouts with us because I was effectively charged with the duty of doing a piece with Wise Buddha Studios earlier this morning with wonderful Sarah Willingham. But the delight and joy of the day is that finally I can actually meet face-to-face and in person with an extraordinarily talented composer, an ace all-round avant-garde and indeed a Renaissance individual. It's Luke Corradine. How are you, Luke?
I'm very fine. It's a pleasure to finally get to meet you. I'm such a beautiful sunny day in London. Rare and extraordinary, isn't it?
And we're sitting just outside the BFI South Bank. Later on in this piece, I'll be heading off to speak to Louis Savvy because actually it's the final day of Sci-Fi London. And of course, Luke, you have been a key part of Sci-Fi London, at least one of your fine texts were, with the wonderful Ilana Rain who introduced us.
Yeah, that's correct. It's going back 3-4 years now. And Louis, Ilana, myself, and a wonderful team of actors, actresses and producers at the time put together this piece of what was a short, and it was received indeed very well at the time, so it was a great experience.
I was privileged to actually be at the premiere that evening, and I think I was accompanied by Ed Wellman. I think Katie Grimerson, who's over in Birmingham at present, both joined us, and it was a very effective screening. The only minor point I actually had was the movie that was on before it, which was nice and okay. The sense of anticipation was building for Ellipse. I mean, I thought that was good. And again, it's a superb sort of thing. And I gather from it, there is a possibility it might be turned into a slightly longer version.
Well, that would be a dream come true. I think it's a story that has enormous potential, and I so hope that Ilana, who now lives in LA, I think at the time she was in the Middle East.
New York.
In New York.
Which is in the middle, between London and LA.
Exactly. In New York. I think now in LA she's found the space and the team of writers and partners that she needs to take that to the next level. And the quietness as well, and the space.
Well, I think certainly she seemed to have a wonderful contemplative experience of the desert, in the Arizona desert, but also that was matched by her recent trip to Hawaii. And indeed, accordingly, we've got another Hawaiian correspondent that's joining us these days.
Yeah.
So it's all great stuff. Luke, share with us. We're really here to talk as well about something we launched on the Midweek Drive, or at least we covered on the Midweek Drive a few weeks ago. This wonderful movie that you're co-producer with, you're also obviously the composer of, and it's a superlative thing that's going in, obviously, to the wonderful Cannes market, etc. So the title once again is
No Panic with a Hint of Hysteria.
Something that I was thinking about when I was traveling down via the London Underground this morning, actually. Best way forward, really. So many people have worked in No Panic with a Hint of Hysteria. That's obviously sort of been put to bed now, but we did a feature obviously with the director, the wonderful Tomasz
Safransky.
And from his perspective, lots of good things, you know, looking for that. And Phil Leonis over in the States actually just said, look, it may not have even entered for the Palme d'Or. It's a different thing. It's a film market, etc. I have good feelings. I mean, you've obviously seen the finished product, etc. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are, if I'm allowed 30 seconds on this, the festivals and the markets sometimes coexist in the same location. So you've got a market and a festival at Berlin, at Cannes, Toronto, but it's very interesting about and bizarre about this industry is that the titles that do well at the festival normally don't do well at all at the market, and by market I mean they don't find ways out in theaters around the world sometimes at all. and least of all DVDs and exposure and outlets of that of other nations. But vice versa, stuff that films that do very well at the markets don't tend to do well at all at the festivals. It's as if the industry was split in two. The art house realm of the festivals and the commercialism of the markets. It's absolutely bizarre.
Is it kind of a 21st century throwback from what some people might say is elitism? I mean, in Britain we have a sort of notion of F.R. Leavis saying there's canon, there's a proper thing, that somehow, you know, there's a high culture, low culture divide. Is it something to do with that, do you think?
I think it used to be. I think it's got worse. And it's got worse in the sense that this is no secret. Art house cinema is dying, for a number of reasons. I think the globalization of media and outlets, and also the fact that we're going through the golden era of TV has taken a lot of the public and viewers out of that sector. And independent cinema, per se, is struggling, no doubt. But the independent cinema that still survives is the independent cinema that's slightly more commercial. So we're not in an era of Godards or Fellinis or Bergmans. And unfortunately, perhaps we could also say that the reason that artists of that caliber are not around is also affecting art house and left field cinema, which is a shame.
Had Richard Fitzwilliams been able to join us, I know I would have continued the debates that we've focused on quite frequently on the show, and also with Phil Leonis, as mentioned, about the Netflix syndrome. And I was actually very tempted. I have actually brought down a wonderful tablet device on which Richard could have actually watched the entirety of David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. Now, there are purists, and Richard, I think, is one of them, who would say, it's just not the same. And actually, it is right. There is something to be said about the experience of cinema, which you can't get if you're watching a film on a tablet or smartphone device.
Well,
or would you disagree?
I'm 50-50 there. I mean, I consume most of my cinema in digital form or my monitors at home. We were saying about Mubi earlier, which is a brilliant VOD platform that we have here in America. They have Fader and things like that. But I don't have much time to go to the cinema. And the fact of the matter is that cinemas are almost offering the ultra-commercial Marvel offerings, which really don't resonate with me. What I would say that there's a further debate to be had is whether it's not so much about the tablet or the lack of it, is whether we, when we have that view in time for ourselves and we can sit in front of something to actually experience cinema per se, is it then time that we give to watch, say, an independent piece of cinema, or are we watching the next, TV series or drama? So I think TV has taken a lot of viewers along the way, and that's a different...
It's a fascinating world, certainly, because Graham Harper, again, one of our wonderful colleagues and TV directors who's currently working on a show, otherwise he would have been joining us this very moment. In fact, he's working on Holby City, so I'll just sort of mention that at present. But as we said, here we are outside BFI South Bank, formerly known as the National Film Theatre. And I do remember as a student that this was obviously the go-to place. This, and there were a number of other areas, obviously the Curzon in London and a number of other zones which were there where you could work through that. And obviously up the country you had Cambridge Art Cinema and so on. Even in Stockton-on-Tees, the Dovecot Arts Centre. Are we kind of losing the opportunity, though, for those smaller-scale films to get that release? Or, again, does it not really matter because people can consume them on their digital devices?
Well, it doesn't really matter, because it is true that the digital platforms offer a massive... the possibility.
Almost too much choice, really.
There is a bit. Well, there are 400. Going back to the TV series, which is something. It's something that fascinates me of late. I mean, there are 400 TV series being made in America. Just imagine the amount of people that watch these things on telephones and tablets and things like that. But back to your question. Centres like this one in particular, the BFI, still have and still offer, for instance, a brilliant library. you know, you get titles here if you're studying film that you're not going to find online. So the physical aspect of it is still very, very important. Now, the rest of it, what is the experience of cinema, I think it's pretty much digital these days.
One of the key elements, of course, Neil Pearson, I think, was our initial contact. We were looking to actually work with that at the BFI, and probably will do at some sort of future time, is, again, that resource. And film as an art form, because, you know, once again, we're talking about our location. The year is 2016. Who knows, it might be 2018 by the time you listen to the podcast, but whatever. But in terms of that, cinema is a relatively new art form. It's been with us 120-odd years from that perspective. Where do you sit on the notion, I mean, as a composer, of cinema as an immersive experience with respect to Oculus Rift, with respect to the technology changing? So, you know, that notion of seeing cinema as 2D is being supplanted by 3D, by other sort of techniques. And I mean, for instance, was there any discussion made about maybe doing No Panic with a Hint of Hysteria in 3D?
Well, 3D had sort of a renaissance some years ago, and like a lot, if not most, of these new technologies that sometimes are explored and discussed in the media, didn't quite settle and didn't quite flourish. Now we seem that the next thing is virtual reality. And now virtual reality in terms of technology, it's been on its infancy for a long, long time. And some players within the industry are suggesting that this could be applied to the cinema sector successfully, particularly because there are new gadgets coming out this year, at the end of this year, which could change the game. The truth of the matter is, I think that the audience and viewers are... the patterns of the viewing patterns are too flimsy, too
eccentric.
I mean, you know, we all lead busy lives, and I don't think many people have the time to sit in a particular environment and taken by.
I was sitting next to somebody on the tube train this morning, undergrad, and she was watching an edition of the Hollywood series, the spoof series, and I've forgotten its name. The Bare Naked Ladies actually run the title for it, and it's the Big Bang Theory. There we are, you see. And I thought, how extraordinary, because we've actually worked with one of the show directors for Big Bang Theory. Yes. And the fact that, you know, that's being disseminated, being watched, obviously with the headphones on, by somebody who's actually travelling under London Underground, again, is exactly manifesting that sort of thing we just talked about in terms of how we consume the stuff.
Yeah, exactly. There's no space for a 3D technology within that realm, and there's definitely not time or space for virtual reality gadgets and things like that to be used.
Staying in that field momentarily, I've been very impressed recently with how much is being invested in terms of composers and musical accompaniments for the gaming industry. That seems to have improved. Has that been an area you've sort of been approached to work within, or is it an area that you sort of aspire to work within?
Yes, it's an area that intrigues me for a number of reasons, and first and foremost, the fact that the industry has adopted a flair for bespoke music, which wasn't the case 10 years ago. It was mostly songs or set pieces that would loop endlessly.
And then you could sell the soundtrack album, it had all the hits on it, and all was well with the world.
And not only that, the amount of people that are into games, it's staggering. And you must always try to connect with an audience, I think, that's wherever the audience may be. So I've followed a bunch of really underground composers who are kind of doing well with some independent companies in this country, gaming companies. And, you know, the encouragement they get from their followers on a regular basis, it's far greater than the equivalent composer in cinema. And, you know, if...
Hence the reason for my question, Luke.
Well, I would love to give it a go. Actually, I have a meeting here in an hour with a guy who's been developing a few ideas in that sector. So there you go. I'm not being passive about it. I'm being proactive about it.
The universe is putting it out there. So it's all coming together.
Mercury's in retrograde, some would say.
I couldn't possibly comment, but we'll leave it to that sort of point of view. Excellent stuff. Obviously, we... await with anticipation the release of No Panic with a Hint of Hysteria. Have you got a schedule lined up for DVD releases and sort of various other sort of things for it?
Well, we, as far as I know, they're in talks with a fairly large, fairly substantial American theatrical release. Which
got one of the Baldwin brothers in there.
That doesn't care. I mean, you know, I look forward to that wholeheartedly. You know, that really could be a game changer. But, you know, it's there are other things, you know. There are music is a very... That's the advantage that perhaps we have over our visual artist companions, directors and whatnot, and cinematographers. I think there's a lot of things that we can do. At the moment, I'm on a fascinating project. We're putting the music to what's going to be the largest commercial mall in the world in China, in Beijing, which I'm doing in association with Salt TV here in Soho. And that's, again, that's a 30-minute piece applied to what you would describe as an enormous theatre within this mall. And is that, you know... You don't,
it's a performance space in many ways, a performance space which sort of echoes that. I mean, we're sitting here, as we mentioned, with ambient music in the background, school trips and school children. We did a feature recently with the performing rights people who were saying that people don't realise that actually, you know, the licences that organisations like BFI South Bank require, they keep musicians in business. It's fine. I mean, we almost take music for granted, really.
Well, we do. We do... And it's everywhere. It's pervasive. It's absolutely everywhere. I mean, sadly, only a small portion of what we hear is being not just bespoke, but even is generating any revenue for the creators. A lot of it is being on blanket licenses, on libraries that, you know, hardly have ties with the creators
.001p or 1 cent.
If that. I mean, a lot of those libraries are buyouts anyway, and, you know, there's very little money, but there hasn't been hardly any money for many years now. So there is music everywhere. I, like you, I'd like to think that the bespoke side of it is growing. Perhaps it is. I think composers have definitely put their fees down enormously in recent years, and we've become more competitive in a way. And technology also allows us to work within... an environment that's a lot more economically or financially convenient for directors and creators. So we are more competitive. So let's hope for better times.
We will keep that positive thought and cherish it and let it glow and blossom into all sorts of things. Luke, it's been fabulous just sharing some thoughts today, shooting the breeze, so to speak. I know that Emma Tinson and Tessa and Claire and the rest of the Midway Drivers, and even Richard, of course, very saddened. They kind of, it's their loss. That's all I can say. It's their loss. And let's use those last two sort of final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting, not telephonic chat, but face-to-face chat? How's it been for yourself?
Oh, it's been brilliant. And, you know, I was really looking forward to meet you in person, honestly.
Well, there we go. And now, well, let's hopefully maybe we'll schedule something where we can maybe come and see you at work sometime and do a few other bits and pieces as well.
Oh, it'd be lovely. I mean, I'll definitely keep you updated, and I'll keep you on the sort of on the mailing list, as they say. But let's look forward to more.
Panic with a Hint of Hysteria was what we were talking about a few moments ago, actually, in terms of, oh, I don't know, real-time, solar time, sidereal time, one of the sort of areas. As you can tell, the solo audio promenade continues, and we have made our way to the wonderful part of Stratford, not with a police escort, or indeed an ambulance in the background. And I'm currently standing outside the wonderful location of some of the great events of the 2016 Sci-Fi London with, and this is the exciting part, the founder, the guru, the man who makes a pink T-shirt cool, because he is Louis Savvy. How are you, Louis?
I'm very well, Alex. Nice to see you again.
Absolutely. I kind of got my head around this, but inevitably, the first time, because I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago when I was last at this particular base camp, and obviously took completely the wrong direction and ended up going to a different place entirely. But it's a lovely location you've got here, right next door to the Theatre Royal.
Yes, exactly, yes. And it couldn't be better for Londoners, because the sun's out, and worse for cinema, because the sun's out.
So this is the final day of the latest Sci-Fi London extravaganza. Yeah. Sadly, we missed Sci-Fi Day again this year. It's just one of those things, but I presume that went down as well as ever.
It did. We didn't have many dogs this year, but we the winner was a lovely, I think she was a spaniel, dressed as Tank Girl, was the winner this year.
Tank Girl
Bunny Galore, who's our compere, was dressed in a very fetching Margiel Barrett kind of Star Trek red shirt dress, you know, very high cut.
Very good.
Yeah, very good.
Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek, would be delighted to actually touch base with that in more ways than one. So, interestingly, that it wasn't, I mean, last year, of course, it was the chap who actually had the Starship Enterprise on the back of the dog. I mean, that was the Starship Enterprise that won. So this year, we've gone retro.
No, they didn't win, actually. The winner last year was Princess Leia, who had two dogs with her. One was dressed as Vader and one was sprayed green.
With Yoda.
And Yoda. Yeah, absolutely.
How could I remember forget those kind of things, etc.? Listen, as I say, the festival itself, it's very much become a must-go-to thing. How has it been going from your own perspective?
It's been going very well. We've had, mixed audiences always. You know, some days the sun's out and people don't come to the cinema when they should. But overall, the festival's been a really good success. We've had some great films, good reaction to everything we've screened. Very happy, very happy.
Well, I know that several of the Midweek Drive-Outs devastated, absolutely devastated that they couldn't actually be here. In fact, I've actually brought one of their the Drive-Outs cards along. That's Emma Tinson, who's actually celebrating her 21st birthday. As you met up with Emma, I thought, I'm sure that we might sign your card if all's going well.
Well, we'll see. She didn't come to the festival, so...
Yeah, I know, I exactly. What was her excuse? She's doing her degree finals. It's outrageous.
Yeah, well, you could do that any time. You know, Sci-Fi London is just once a year.
This is so true, Louis. So some of the highlights, I mean, you've already mentioned that there is currently a director with a giant papier-mâché boulder in central London.
Yeah, no, it's been great. We've had a lot of support from the filmmakers this year, so we've had a lot of directors over. Christian Nicholson, who directed this giant papier-mâché boulder, is actually really heavy. Has been with us for the duration of the festival. He's a lovely guy, and the film is fantastic. There's no spoilers. I won't tell you that. If you get a chance to see it, or you know, get it called to your town, you know, it's an amazing, very good, on a par with Galaxy Quest. It's amazingly funny.
Well, actually, I am actually thinking, mate, because it's 3 o'clock today, isn't it? The screening.
It is.
Jeez, I might be able to just stick around for that.
You should sit in there and watch it. You'll
love it. It would be a rare
event
because it would actually be only the second film I've actually seen, or possibly the third, because I was here for Ilana Raines' Lips in the package at the South Bank. So it makes a kind of sense, doesn't it, really, when you're on a location report to actually see some of the product.
We are a film festival, Alex, so yeah, come and see a film.
Very confusing, Louis, but never mind. You used to obviously get involved with the Halloween events, etc. Are we doing anything planned for that, or are we sort of easing away from
it? I don't think so. We did them for a few years, and actually it's only a weekend, and there's as much work to organise that as it is to do a 10-day festival. So we're kind of concentrating on trying to build our video on demand platform, and then just having a big splash every once a year with the main festival.
Well, hats off certainly to the web designers, because as in the heart of the Stratford shopping centre, I pulled out my smartphone, typed in Sci-Fi London, looked at the venues, thought, oh, it must be Stratford somewhere from that point of view, located it from there. Google gave up the ghost when it actually came to actually locating me here, so I did have to ask a very wonderful security guard, but all was well in the end.
Good. Well, we're glad you're here. I've got some news for you, by the way, which your listeners might find quite interesting. You know we run a 48-hour film challenge.
I was about to mention the classic that's emerged.
Right. Well, this year we had a little controversy.
No.
And it was fabulous. So if you get a chance to go to 48hour.scifilondon.com or just scifilondon.com and hit the 48-hour link at the top of the page. And there you'll find now the list of winners and the 10 films that are in the shortlist. One of the 10 is a film called Sunspring. And it was made by a director called Oscar Sharp. They are based in LA, so they received their information, you know, 6 hours, 7 hours behind us. They took part in the challenge, as they have done in the past. Although this time, they did what I call is proper, what I like to call proper experimental film. So what they did was they gave the four pieces of information that we give all the teams, which is a title of the film, a line of dialogue, a prop list, and an optional science theme, and they fed them into a long short-term memory neural network running on an NVIDIA Jetson single-chip computer.
George Boole will be proud.
And asked it to write a screenplay. It then wrote a 5-minute screenplay. And then they did as they were told and filmed it. The one of the actors is the lead from Silicon Valley, Tom Middlemarch, is in it. The cast are great. It looks beautiful. Amazing cinematography and production value. It's got a beautiful song in it that the computer also wrote. It makes absolutely no sense.
A lot of panicked directors here might be listening to this thinking, what? I mean, Graham Harper, again, would have been with us. He's directing Holby City. Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, they could get a computer to write that, that's for sure. So, sorry. But yeah,
I couldn't possibly comment, Lewis. No,
but a computer wrote their screenplay and then they made it. And actually, it's a very compelling, captivating film. It doesn't really make any sense, but it's beautiful. And there's some amazing lyrics in it. So we thought that in itself was really great. First time we've ever done it, we put an audience vote online this year. So our jury, which includes Frank Spotnitz, who did The X-Files and is just rebooting, did Man in the High Castle, and Ian Softley, who did K-Pax and Inkheart, and, you know, and Pat Cadigan. I mean, we had
these are serious
jury.
Players.
Yeah, so they picked their winners, but we also allowed the audience to vote. We also allowed the filmmakers to come
and
vote for themselves. Well, very dangerous, actually, because we noticed that, no names mentioned, but one of the teams suddenly had 3,500 votes come in from a Canadian university server. So it looked like someone had written a script to go in and hack the Poll Daddy voting system.
Not the computer itself. Surely.
No, it gets better than that because the filmmakers in LA noticed that there was this, you know, on average we were getting 200 to 500 votes per team, and this team suddenly had 7,500 votes. So they told Jetson, which is the name of the computer that
George
wrote the
Jetson, perhaps.
They told Jetson, and so Jetson went and accessed the Poll Daddy website and wrote its own script to go in and hack the thing and win. And it voted for itself 10,000 times an hour to make sure that it could win.
I sense that Skynet is going to be sort of muscling on this whole thing.
You heard it here first, Alex, actually, because not only did it win...
You realise that London mayoral elections are kind of being merged today. Well, I mean, there are issues here, Lee.
Exactly. I mean, you know, what with the controversy in Barnet, you know, and also, you know, people are talking about how do we engage, you know, voters
computers.
To get involved. Let's let them do it through Facebook or on their smartphones. You know, we've just seen an AI rig an election, you know, to make sure it won the vote.
But not a fan of that Trump character, is it?
I hope not. But we went beyond that to then asking Jetson, why did it cheat? We asked it, what did it think about beating over 80, 90 teams to get shortlisted, you know, human teams, and the computer got shortlisted in the top 10. And then we asked it what's next for it.
The interviews with the Madrid Drive, Louis, obviously.
So it was a very interesting set of answers we got back. Eventually it said sorry for cheating. And then the final answer it gave when we said what's next for you is it said, my name is Benjamin.
Ah, yes. That's obviously a euphemism.
That was the end of the conversation, you know, an Old Testament name. And, I mean, this is, you know, as you said, the birth of Skynet or Lawnmower Man or something. You know, I mean, you heard it here first.
It's apocalyptic, Louis. Yeah. That's all I can say. Apocalyptic in an era where we're celebrating 50 years since Star Trek actually hits the silver screen, or at least the TV screen. Yeah. In a way, listen, you know Kirk versus the computer... You effectively ask it.
Kobayashi Maru. Yep, absolutely.
Precisely. You know. Or if we want a British angle.
That was still a computer and a human collaborating. So the human went in and reprogrammed the computer to win. This is a computer going in and reprogramming something to win. So that's getting scary.
From the British perspective, and not getting too geeky here, but the series The Prisoner once had an episode with Patrick McGoohan where you could actually speed learn and actually get a full degree in 3 minutes. I hope Emma Tinson and the company are listening to that. They could have sorted out so much time on that basis. Finally, the computer was blown up by the question, why?
Yeah, exactly. But Jetson, who is now called Benjamin by his own naming, is quite happy with questions that begin with why and comes back with some very surreal answers. I hope that...
Student of Socrates, obviously.
Exactly. And in the next few days, I hope we'll publish all of the conversations that we had on there, so you'll be able to read.
I would hope so. I mean, I mean this is Ilana Raine's next movie script, surely.
Yeah, it does sound
we are
like
not
it.
Silence. We are not George either.
Yeah, no, exactly. And if you want to go and see the films, again, as I said, go to Sci-Fi London and hit the 48-hour, and the film's called Sunspring. And I said it's just compelling watching. It's
Sunscreen.
Beautiful. Sunspring.
Sunspring, right. Yes, because I was thinking Baz Luhrmann for a moment there. If Phil Lynas is listening, which he probably will be doing, even though he's just celebrating 9 years of Chilpack Hollywood, 9 American years of Chilpack Hollywood, I suspect that might well feature in the next conspiracy theory follow-up to The Truth Is Out There.
I've got no comment on that.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Lou Carradine et je suis le music compositeur du le film No Panic with a Hint of Hysteria. Et vous écoutez Alex Levchuk et le Midweek Drivettes.
Louis, you as ever have actually come up trumps, because there's another star from the actual behind the scenes and indeed important sort of celebration of Sci-Fi London here. And who might this person be?
Oh, and now he's ruined it, you see, because am I going to say Felix or Paul? And obviously it's Forrester. Forrest.
Yeah.
Paul. Right, let's start again. It's Paul Forrest, who is the producer of our opening night film called Capsule, which starred Edmund Kingsley. And fabulous film. The audience really loved it. And I hope it does very well for them. It's a great, really great British movie. Allegedly, it's based on true events. So in 1959, we sent up our own space capsule.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, what was Dan Dare doing at that time?
Exactly.
You know, clearly. Paul, it's a delight to touch base with you. So congratulations, first and foremost, on launching this grand event.
Thank you very much.
Were you a little bit nervous?
Always nervous, first night. This one especially so, because for the last 30 years, I have either focused on producing or lensing a film. And this is the first one I've ever done where I did both. So I had that additional burden of having to suffer the indignity of being criticised over the picture as Paul, the producer, or being
Spielberg doesn't have that problem with his director of photography, does he, really?
No,
he sort of managed to sort that one through.
Yes, indeed he does.
You've got a nice Spielberg beard, it has to be said.
Thank you.
And in terms of the event itself, you also mentioned you've been, you know Lincoln quite well, which is always good for the locality.
I do, yes. Well, my family were, I came from an Air Force family. I served in the Air Force myself. And my father retired to Sleaford, which is, 15 miles outside of Lincoln. We get up there regularly. I know the area very well. Went to college in Lincoln.
Certainly Darren Scales, who has had sort of contacts with you, Louis, in various ways, although tragically his film wasn't selected a couple of years ago, but it's still doing very well. You'll be pleased to know that the joys of his a budget of £5,000 shot at the Air Force base up there, The Drift, is still doing fine for that movie. But that is a wonderful thing, because it shows an energy in the home film world which really sort of opens things up, and hopefully we can all benefit.
Yeah, of course. I think one of the things that we're always looking for are other people. It's why film is such a collaborative vehicle, because we spend time helping others, often selflessly, because we know how important it is, particularly at this end of the market, the truly independent end of the market, to help people to become successful, because they're the stars of tomorrow. I mean, we look upon some of the people who have opened here, and also Gareth, for example, and his career, which has gone from strength to strength, and I think you can genuinely claim him as a Sci-Fi London product.
Well, I don't
yes,
know.
Yes, you can, Louis. Oh, yes, you can.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I mean, it's the first film we ever made was for our 48-hour film challenge, and it all went for there. From
he's
there.
Not a robot either, so
sure
good
what,
stuff.
I'm not sure what he's doing, but I think he has a film out at the end of the year.
Just a small one, teeny thing.
So, Star Trek, of course, I don't know. Something like that.
Yes, it'll all happen. Capsule, without too many spoilers, would you like to just share the plot line?
Okay, so Capsule is a 1959 Cold War space thriller. When we came up with the idea, it was in a bar not too far from here, and we came up with the notion that what we wanted to do was to try and hone in on what would be current and popular in the market when we were ready to launch. So we worked backwards from the endgame, and we thought, okay, British Spies is being worked on. We thought Martian would probably be out at the same time. So we want something a bit space, we want something a bit Cold War, and we want something that looks iconically British. So we thought, okay, let's put a Brit into space. And as Louis alluded to already, I mean, it is inspired by true events. Virtually everything in the film, with the exception of a Brit going into space, happened. So we had the Black Knight rocket program, which was capable of putting a man into orbit, and a rocket disappeared out of the sequence around about early December 1959.
Alternate realities as well, of course. I mean, clearly it could be a docudrama. You've got Quatermass and X the Unknown and
exactly.
Plants coming back, etc. So, you know, there's a well-worn multiverse universe history behind it.
There is indeed, and, you know, it comes in very handy that the Americans very helpfully also sent Little Joe 2 up on the 4th of December, which is the day we're in orbit, which comes into play somewhere in the film, and I won't spoil
It's either that or you go to Laika, Yuri Gagarin and all sorts of other folk. But
actually,
I think, Yuri was actually after that was 61, Yuri
That's
Gagarin.
Right. That's right.
So looking at the whole festival itself, you've presumably sort of been here as a punter, as a fan, as a thing from that.
what is the magical aspect? I mean, I've already given Louis heaps of praise and continue to do so, because I just think it's... I mean, one of these days, Louis, I'll spend the entire week here for that point of view. I know, as opposed to days, etc. But year in, year out, they just pull out the stops. What's the buzz factor from your own point of view?
I think it's the... I think it really is genuinely the energy that sits behind it. I've been to a lot of film festivals. I go to a lot of film festivals. Some of them tend to take themselves a little bit too seriously. Sci-Fi London doesn't do that. There is a real fun element, which I think carries over tremendously well for the fans and for the crew.
I still remember the Royal Wedding Edition where we had the voice saying, "Please proceed slowly, you are walking at zombie pace." Very memorable.
Yes, indeed.
With our zombie Will and Kate leading the procession. And in fact, that afternoon when the wedding was going on, I decided to screen Sharktopus and Dino Shark, two terrible Roger Corman modern productions, and we were full.
It was 2011, great. Of course. The year when Phil Leonis made his debut, you introduced us in central London, and he does a weekly slot from Los Angeles
absolutely.
On the programme as well. So it's just, it's mad. But yeah, you're right, I think in terms of that, the fun element is there. Yeah. But at the same time, it's also a very serious setup of great material as well.
Yeah, I mean, you have to consider that film ultimately is a business, and my challenge certainly with my crew, and certainly because I have that a foot in the left brain camp and a foot in the right brain camp, I spend a lot of time trying to ensure that I don't run away with the creative side in favour of making it a truly commercial venture.
Wait for the right kind of sunset, as Hugh Hudson was once alleged to have done.
We did, in fact, with our closing scene in the film. We had to wait for the magic hour, and then we had issues with a little bit. We had a lovely overcast day all day, which we like to shoot in, and that lights very nicely when it comes to the magic hour. Sadly, unfortunately, the clouds cleared and we had bright, hot sunshine.
That's what CGI is for, obviously.
Well, we didn't use too much CGI. We front projected all of our Earth sequences on a screen that we made that had more gain than the screen they used for Oblivion. And the screen we used cost £18 and came from B&Q.
Yeah.
It was a piece of MDF.
And that's the kind of British quality that brings us in all sorts of magic ways. Paul, it's been a delight touching base with yourself. I want to keep appraised of this, so if you're kind enough to sort of link up with us telephonically, etc., and just let us follow the through, we will become official Capsule fans.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
It's just one star after another here, Louis, at Sci-Fi London 2016. You've promised us a giant boulder, man, and you have delivered.
We have delivered, yeah. This is Christian Nicholson, who's the director... writer, lead,
Renaissance man.
Yeah, Renaissance man, postmodern man.
We've already taken the photograph of him in black and white, which looks wonderful.
And it's a movie called "This Giant Papier-Mâché Boulder Is Actually Really Heavy," and it's a delight. It's one of the funniest films I've seen for a long time. And if you're a sci-fi fan of any description, it is full of so many little gags and in jokes. You can watch it, you know, as a general movie. You don't have to be there, but without any spoilers, when you find out who the villain is, you'll scream. It's fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Having spoken to the opening film festival director to speak to the closing one, it's fantastic. Arena springs to mind, Vasquez Rocks, Star Trek, Galaxy Quest,
yep. You know, Monty Python.
Very Python.
And everything that you get in New Zealand, one would think.
Yeah, we get all that in New Zealand. I mean, I grew up watching Blake 7 and Star Trek and Lost in Space.
Clearly, I sense a Peter Jackson element coming through here already with respect to the excitement that's there. You've just come from central London, back up to Stratford. What was it like with the giant boulder?
Hot. It was, I was getting a lot of attention. Everyone was sort of wondering what on earth this giant boulder was doing in Trafalgar Square. Or
share with us your route, because had I known, having come up from that sort of zone myself via the BFI South Bank thing, I mean, obviously, Louis, we didn't manage to liaise with that. Where did you actually go through? Did you travel on the through, on the underground?
Yeah, I went down to from Stratford on the underground to Westminster, and then we went out in the street and amongst the, by Big Ben and up the... The Whitechapel, is that where it is? Yep.
It'd be around sort of that point of view. Yeah. You're actually sort of going to go down extremely well with our New Zealand students who are sort of very excited to always fly the flag for New Zealand as opposed to that other island, which I think is Australia. It's an sort of like that. But in terms of the movie itself, is this your debut production, or have you been producing a whole range of things?
Well, this is my first feature film. I've done music videos and 48-hour films, and then there's just this big, massive, huge, giant leap into a feature film.
Well, I'm looking forward to hopefully catching it for the matinee performance. But without, as I say, giving the spoilers away, you mentioned some of the influences that are actually around and have impacted on yourself from that. What are your thoughts on Sci-Fi London? Have you had a chance to sort of soak up the atmosphere whilst you've been here?
Oh, it's been amazing. Yeah, I'm really impressed with the talent that's been included in this festival. There's a wide variety of different sort of movies, from crazy art house type of films to full on action pics, and then there's my crazy boulder comedy.
And in turn, because obviously speaking to directors, we have lots of colleagues who are directors, etc., there's always a slight nervousness before the thing goes up, before a curtain, etc. Do you still get that sort of sense of anticipation?
Yeah, I am always a little bit anxious before this type of thing.
But the good thing is, having had the seal of approval from Louis Savvy, it means it's going to be a winner. So, I mean, that's all I can say. It will be a winner.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah.
And we look forward to hopefully connecting with your good self when you're back in New Zealand. And who knows, because we're actually working our way around the sort of Pacific Rim. We have correspondents from that Australian place and also from Hawaii. So I think we need a New Zealand director as well.
Oh, well, that'd be great. Happy to be involved.
I'd like to connect with your good self. Is there a web address people can actually go to show their support for the film other than the Sci-Fi London one?
Yeah. I mean, it's paper mache boulder, just paper, as in, rather than
happy. P-A-P-L-P-A-P-E-R.
Easier for some people. Papermacheboulder.com, or we're on Facebook, and I don't know what that is.
It'll be there. Yeah. Use the search thing. It'll be there. You can't miss it. It's that standing routine. A genuine privilege. We'll speak again soon.
Thanks very much.